From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, she's no longer the interim head of the EAA. Now she's permanent chancellor. What are Veronica Conforme's goals?
The EAA has to succeed because the children, the schools in the EAA deserve a fighting chance.
We look at the border between Detroit and Grosse Pointe Park.
The fact that it's majority black on one side and still majority white on the other causes its own kinds of tension.
And we review the iconic career of Bill Bonds. A legendary Detroit TV anchor died over the weekend. Just what did his viewers come to expect from Bonds?
I think what they expected is they would know the truth.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. It has been called the most conspicuous city-suburban contrast in the United States, the border between Detroit and Grosse Pointe Park. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we look at the long, tense history of that Detroit-Grosse Pointe divide. But first, the Education Achievement Authority has a permanent leader. Some 6 months after being appointed interim chancellor, Veronica Conforme was named chancellor. What has she seen in these first months, and what are her goals now that she is permanent chancellor? Veronica Conforme, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. Really happy to be here. Really happy to talk with you and your listeners about what's happening in education.
Veronica, you succeeded John Covington. We've spoken to him on this program, and he stepped down with about a year left on his contract. There were some questions about his leadership and the credit card spending, and more so the direction of the EAA. What did you find when you got here that you wanted to correct immediately?
What I've been focused on in the first few months as interim chancellor has been two main goals. One has been around enhancing our student experience, ensuring that they have classrooms and rooms that are safe and nurturing and focused on improving academic achievement. And the second goal has been really doing an organizational review of our internal operations and how EAA is working, what are the things that are working, what are the things that are not working. And I've been doing a lot of listening, lots of community events, staff forums at each of our schools, and really just conducting a top-to-bottom review and assessing what operations need to improve. So, and moved on some things already, like improving our financial controls, implementing conflict of interest rules, so that we can hold our employees to the highest standard of performance.
Why did you feel that conflict of interest policy was needed?
There was a policy in place, but standard practice and good practice in at least organizations that I've worked in is that employees would sign off on the conflict of interest form and that there would be an operational mechanism to operationalize that. And what I mean by that is that there will be a phone number, a website where people can report any perceived or any issues that they see both in schools and in our office.
When you came here from New York, what did you have as your view of the mission of Michigan's EAA?
I think the mission is really clear. We have to find the best talent, support them, create the opportunity for them to be successful with our most struggling students.
Veronica, what were some of the issues that you were perhaps not expecting in terms of fitting your vision and then taking that and the day-to-day reality of running these 15 schools?
You know, I think it's probably not that I wasn't expecting it, but I am relentlessly focused on students' success and the successful outcome of students. And I think that we do that in, we are on our path to doing that. But I think the work there is more to come in this work. We are nowhere near where we need to be. And the challenge is really how do you accelerate the learning?
How important are those spring tests in your mind?
Well, there are changes in the tests, but spring tests are one measure of how we're doing, an important measure, but one measure of whether we're moving students. And I think they are important, I think there are other measures, and we should be talking about other measures like the quality of work and evidence produced by students. And there's a variety of mechanisms to evaluate that performance.
Speaking of getting students ready for college, this is before you came, but we had heard from graduating seniors last spring who just couldn't even get their transcripts in order to submit them to colleges. What's been done to change that and to just sharpen things up administratively and to support these kids?
Yep. So I did hear that. I heard that actually on my first day as interim, and it is unacceptable. You know, we need to position our students to be successful in college, and that is just the basic level. So we have looked at our transcript system and our student records and have focused a lot of time over the last couple of months cleaning a lot of that data up so the students who are seniors currently are able to get transcripts, and all of our student records are up to par. We're not quite done with that, but it is in a much better state.
We're speaking with the newly appointed chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority, Veronica Conforme. She was interim for a few months, and now she has the gig as a permanent chancellor. I know that you came in aware that there were a lot of criticisms of the EAA, with critics saying scores weren't what were promised. They point to 24% of the students who left in the second year, that buzz system, the education software, was riddled with glitches. You've got state legislators have put a hold on expanding the EAA to more schools. And then Eastern Michigan University has been taking a lot of heat from its professors and students for being involved with the EAA. How do you respond to this kind of torrent of criticism?
The EAA has to succeed because the children of Detroit and the children of the schools in the EAA deserve a fighting chance and deserve a new direction. We know for a fact that graduation rates, test scores, as one example, have indicated that the performance has been unacceptably low, and we need to break that cycle, and we need to move in a new direction. So that's what I would say to folks that have concerns. How we get there, more than open to discussing what that looks like. I think it's a new day. We are correcting many of the issues that folks have raised in the past. We are listening actively to the community and to parents and to our teachers who are doing the hard work every day. And I believe that we're going to move in a new direction that is going to improve the lives of our students.
Former EAA teachers have actually told Michigan Radio they feel that at the beginning when things were launched that they were set up to fail. One teacher said that the emphasis was so much on buzz that anything that seemed like traditional or whole group teaching was treated with, in his words, contempt. Tell us what you want the climate to be like for your teachers.
I've spent a lot of time with teachers over the last couple of months. As I said, I've done a teacher forum in every single one of our schools where I've basically said to teachers, tell me what you're thinking, what you're feeling, how we can support you better. And what I've been clear on is what we want is for students to be successful. That's the goal. And could we leverage technology like tools like the ones we use currently? Sure. But the most important thing is are students learning, and are they in a safe and nurturing environment, and are we making progress with our students? So how we get there, I have been very clear that my expectation is that is a conversation between the principal and teachers, and that those closest to students are making the most important decisions. So I understand that there was perhaps a focus to use certain products, et cetera. I have said use the products as it moves achievement and as you are able to reach students for more flexibility. Not because we are somehow using it as compliance.
What do you need, Veronica, from Lansing to help the EAA reach the goals you have in your mind for it?
Well, I need for folks, and some have already started, for folks to come and visit and to be open to the conversation. I would love for more support from all elected officials and support to actually come and see what's going on and give us feedback, and we're open to the feedback, but to actually come and see before people make judgments on it. So I would like openness and an opportunity to have people come and visit and dialogue with us.
What about funding? It's been a challenge.
So funding, we are a pretty lean organization. Most of our dollars go directly to our schools for all the services and support. Funding's a great thing. It's always great to have more funding. But I also understand the economic realities in which we live in this state.
How long do you think we should give the EAA to succeed and to really prove that scores are turned around? And it's, as you say, it's about the kids, and that the kids are having a good experience and they're learning.
I think you're starting to see some success. We started with 15 schools in the EAA, and we are now, three of those schools are now not in the priority list any longer. They have moved out of the bottom 5%. So there is some movement in a positive direction. I think that over the next year and 2 years, you will start to see things continue to move in that direction.
Veronica Conforme, we thank you for speaking with us, and we know we'll be talking to you more in the future.
Okay. Thank you so much, Cynthia. It was a pleasure, and hopefully we will continue to connect and connect with your listeners.
Veronica Conforme, the newly named Chancellor of the Education Achievement Authority. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His former boss once remarked, Bill Bonds could read the telephone book and make you pay attention. The legendary Detroit television anchor died over the weekend at age 82. Anybody who watched television in Southeast Michigan from the 1960s into the mid-90s knew Bill Bonds. He feared no one, as you can hear in this live interview with U.S. Senator Orrin Hatch.
Joining us now live by way of the Newstar 7 satellite for Senator Orrin Hatch of the state of Utah. Sir, I have to say to you, sir, just as an American from the Midwest, that frankly, you and your colleagues on the Senate Judiciary Committee with some of your cheap shots at one another, that was kind of an embarrassing spectacle. Do you regret that that went on?
Well, I didn't see any real cheap shots. You know, it was a tense, difficult process, as it should be. And it was made even worse because of one dishonest senator who leaked raw FBI data that then became public.
Senator, and you guys leak all the time.
No, that's not true.
Who are you trying to kid? You guys leak stuff all the time.
Let me just say something. That's not true.
Yes,
there
it
are
is.
People who no, not FBI reports from the Judiciary Committee. This
leaks
is one
leaks.
Area. Look, I've been there 15 years. I know what's gone on there.
There are people who think maybe you guys have been there too long.
And that could be in 15 yeah. years for a week.
Okay. Your conduct was great. You guys all look terrific. 250 million Americans are really proud of Senator Orrin Hatch and all the rest of you guys.
Well,
you did a marvelous job. We're all proud of you. You never made the country look better. Let me ask you something. What are you going to do if you find out 6 months from now that Clarence Thomas, who you've just about made into a saint, is a porno freak, if that leaks out?
Well, don't worry, we won't, but I'll tell you, I think if you're going to interview us in the future, you ought to be at least courteous. I think you're about as discourteous a person as I've ever interviewed with. And I don't like it, and I don't like what you're doing. If you don't like what we're saying, you don't like what we do, say so.
Well, I
appreciate that, but don't act like that with me. Look, I go through enough crap back here, I don't have to go through it with you.
Well,
and let me tell you something.
No, let me tell you something.
Tell yourself something. I'm tired of talking to you.
Okay, fine. I'm tired of talking to you. See you later. That was Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah. He hasn't changed his mind since he was elected 15 years ago. And, hey, he's got his beliefs and we have ours.
Dick Kernan is with us now from the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, a longtime observer of Michigan's media scene who actually worked with Bill Bonds. Dick, we're laughing. Detroiters, Michiganders know him. Folks from outside who didn't know Bill Bonds, jaws are hitting the ground right now.
Yeah. Nobody does that.
Nobody does that. They really broke the mold with Bill Bonds, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did. I mentioned to either Tim Kiska or the other guy from the Free Press, they said, can you teach that? I said, if we could teach that, you couldn't afford to come here. you either have that or see ya. I mean, he was just a very unusual guy that had these diverse images. I mean, what we just heard, you know, and if you think that was just for senators, I mean, Bill would do the same thing if it was me or you.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, he could be the most charming guy in the room.
What did viewers expect from Bill Bonds, and what did he deliver to them?
I think what they expected is they would know the truth, that he wasn't going to eliminate anything that was a negative or, you know, gild the lily, as we used to say. They knew that he was going to tell it exactly like it was. I think, and he proved it again with with that thing you just played, which is great. I couldn't believe it. Okay, goodbye. Wow.
I know.
He did the same thing, you know, his coverage of the 67 riots were, you know, just amazing. He was definitely one of a kind. It's taken nothing away from the other people who do that for a living, but he was a very special, very unique guy.
And it was a love-hate thing viewers would have, but they watched, didn't they, whether they loved him or hated him.
Yeah. You just, you know, it was hard to ignore him.
Bill Bonds tried the New York and Los Angeles television markets, but always wound up coming back to Michigan. What was uniquely Detroit or uniquely Michigan about Bill Bonds?
Well, I think the fact that, you know, there are a lot of us, I'm assuming present company included, that are from here. And, there are people that leave here all the time and go to California or go to New York. I think the Detroit market has always been, boy, I don't know. I'd hate to, don't take me to court on this. But I think one of the things, and Bill personified that, is the identity coming from this town. That's a bad description. I apologize, but I think that there is just something that for a lot of people is very unique to Southeast Michigan and isn't replicated anyplace else.
Yeah, there you go. When it really becomes a part of people's lives, welcomed into their living rooms or their kitchens each night, the news.
Yeah.
Bill waged a very, very public battle with alcohol addiction, didn't he?
Boy, didn't he.
Yeah.
I mean, you got to give the guy credit. He was very, you know, it's typical Bill Bonds. You know, he's not about to kid you about it. And, that's a tough thing to deal with. And, ultimately, I mean, it took a while, that's for darn sure. But ultimately, he beat it.
You are in the business of training broadcasters. And when you look at who's sitting in anchor chairs today, and not just in Detroit, but today in general, no one's challenging mayors to boxing matches anymore.
It doesn't happen, does it?
No. Are the days of that Bond-style swagger and character, are those over now on TV news sets? Is there less tolerance of these kind of colorful characters?
I think it may be over locally. But then, you know, I am a major, major fan of the Daily News, of the Daily Show, and of John Oliver and Bill Maher, and you know those guys certainly personify the same thing Bill personified. I believe it's called telling it like it is. And you know, it may be that given the situation today, you know, if you're a local anchor, I mean, that's a, you know, you can do an awful lot of damage. And to say, well, yeah, but Bill got away with it, I don't think that's going to save your job.
Yeah. So What lessons do you think today's young broadcasters that you're training might take from watching clips of Bill Bonds and kind of hearing how demanding he was and how exacting he was, and he wanted well-written copy and he wanted things accurate? What could they learn from him?
I'm not sure I'd even expose him to it, Cynthia. You don't get to do that until you have created a reputation. You know, Bill didn't always do that. It grew over, a period of time. And to say to people, yeah, go out and hang up on a senator from Utah, I don't think somebody coming into the business, he's got a long way to go before they have a reputation that would allow them to pull that off. I mean, that was a very tough thing to do. I mean, look at all the other people that didn't do it. I mean, we're talking about, I'm not going to name names, but,
sure.
I'm sure you can guess, not to take anything away from him. It's just to say that he was so unique in having that presence that allowed him to pull that stuff off. I would sure not encourage my students to challenge the mayor of some little town up north to a fist fight. I just don't think it'd be good for their career.
Dick Kernan is with the Spex Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield as we look back over the career of legendary Detroit TV anchor Bill Bonds, who died over the weekend at age 82. Dick, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for calling.
Vision.
The best and the brightest.
The next idea.
When we really see each other, we want to help each other.
Is Michigan just too modest, too Midwestern in the way we treat our promising entrepreneurs? Jeff DeGraff is back with us, and he thinks the answer might be yes. Jeff's a clinical professor of management and organizations at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan and our partner for The Next Idea. Jeff, your latest essay makes the case that we could do a whole lot better in this state, making our best and brightest entrepreneurs feel special. Are they not really getting the love they should?
Well, I think they're not. And the evidence is they leave. And one of the lines of sight that I have is I can't tell you over the years how many students I've had at the University of Michigan in my leading innovation class who've gone on to become incredibly successful in other places in the world, in California and in New York and in Massachusetts. And the real question becomes, why do they leave? And part of the reason that they leave is that there's no real special consideration for somebody who's got a great new business idea. There's no availability of capital. There's no putting that person in contact with maybe a larger company that might become a client to that idea, service, product that they've got. So there are really no on-ramps for that young person to thrive here.
What should change then?
Well, I think there has to be a couple things that change. One of the things that we often don't talk about is what keeps a person in an environment, what makes that vibrant. And it has a lot to do with what goes on socially, the arts, what goes on in terms of the recreational possibilities, how good the schools are, et cetera. And there are places that we have in our state that I don't think we've done a particularly great job in promoting as well as we could. So, for example, every time I take a young person and we maybe do a jump start or we do a project up in the Great Lakes area of Traverse City or Petoskey or all the way up into Mackinac Island, there's always this kind of feeling like, man, you guys can keep a secret. And, could a business be put up here? And the answer, of course, is yes, it could. And I don't even dare take them to the Upper Peninsula where things are amazing up there. Think about the way everything looks and think about the cost of property, et cetera. So there's a lot of things that we have here that we're not promoting. We have 95% of all the fresh water in the United States. We have 12,000 in the lakes. It's a recreational paradise. The license plates here used to say Winter Water Wonderland, right? So the notion is the first thing I would do is I would really promote the state, and the Pure Michigan campaign I think is brilliant, but I would really promote it also for young people to stay here. So maybe we're making a bridge between Pure Michigan as a tourist destination and Pure Michigan as a place you might want to put a stake down, and maybe eventually if you have a family, you might want to have a family. The second thing is, instead of having a wider net and looking at everybody in this economy. I think it'd be very smart to look at a handful of people, and the people who would look at these small group of high potential people would be known job creators in the state of Michigan, people who had already created some revenue in this state and created a lot of resources in the state, a lot of jobs in the state. Ask them to select a select group, give that select group availability to capital, availability to maybe some marketing organizations that can sell outside of the state, so on and so forth.
Kind of roll out the red carpet to that best and brightest.
Yes, and with the caveat, with the understanding that as it goes from being a startup to something that's like a mid-size firm or a larger firm, that there are obligations that these people have. And the obligations are going to be relatively small compared to the obligations you're going to have if a venture capitalist in Silicon Valley gives you money. The hurdle is much less.
What kind of obligations should they have, do you think?
I think there ought to be a condition about jobs, that there's a certain type of job that we're trying to create here. So it's not just the number of jobs. Mm-hmm. We want professional jobs. We want to create some middle class jobs, if you will, here in this state. There should be something about in fact, reinvesting in the state. That's one of the things you see a lot, whether you go to the Research Triangle or Silicon Valley. You see a lot of these entrepreneurs who create these companies. They also have an obligation to reinvest in that immediate economy so that the economy keeps going. And this obligation is not a legal one. This obligation is more of a moral one. It's more of one that's a condition of how the culture works, how we invest here. And I think this would be a great thing to start here.
Are we seeing models that we can study where they are doing this successfully elsewhere, where they really are showing the love to those best and brightest?
Yes. One of my favorites is in a place you'd never expect, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, where what they have is a model is they have these series of buildings where young entrepreneurs, maybe one or two people with a wet lab, start, and then they move up the hallway in the building to where it's maybe a company of, let's say, 10 people, and they move up the hallway into the building. And in between all these kind of levels, there's legal advice and there's capital advice. And at the end of the hallway, like in a great big shopping mall, there is like, you know, Texas Instruments or Genentech. And what's happening is it gives everybody a line of sight, and it really moves you from being the small potato to being sort of the big pin, if you will,
yeah,
in that corridor.
Well, how do we measure, Jeff, who's the best and the brightest? How do we choose who gets the extra helping hand and who doesn't?
Well, the first thing we have to do is remember that politics aren't economics, and it's not going to fall in this nice way that we all want it to fall eventually. It's going to have to start in kind of an asynchronous way. So the way it's going to start, I think, is you have the people who've already built businesses pick the next generation. And we're going to learn very quickly what works and what doesn't. Or putting it another way, who works and who doesn't. We can keep score. And we can keep score by things like the number of jobs they create or the amount of revenue that they've got. But this isn't going to be an overnight thing. This is going to be a longer runway, maybe 4 or 5 years. But what we're going to do is we're going to have a rolling evolutionary process where we're going to make adjustments. We're going to do more of one type of a metric or mm-hmm. one type of indicator, and we're going to do less of another over time.
In fact, speaking of developing and rolling this out, why should we limit the special treatment just to entrepreneurs? How about the state's best doctors or best social workers or best teachers?
Oh, that's a great idea. And I'm a boomer, and one of the things that boomers are really big on is meritocracy. You know, your longings are democratic. We want to include everyone, but you also want to let your best and your brightest lead. And if you do that, you have to trust the process that they'll create jobs and revenue, and that will cascade out. Now, of course, there are larger questions about, is the wealth being shared and mm-hmm. is the system fair? Those are questions I don't think we can answer in our little segment here, and those are much deeper kind of societal questions. But I think in general, what you need is momentum and an economic engine, and I think the best and the brightest will do that for you.
Well, we want to kind of get people thinking and offering ideas, and with that, we want you to toss a question at people.
Well, the question I have for everyone is, how would you identify the best and the brightest? And a second question I'd add is, what kinds of help would you give them?
Shoot us your answers and share your thoughts. You can follow us on Twitter at NextIdeaMI or on Michigan Radio's Facebook page, or you can go to the Next Idea link at MichiganRadio.org. Jeff DeGraff, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. To anyone who's taking a first-time drive, the border between Detroit and the city of Grosse Pointe Park gives you a real eye-opening lesson in racial and economic disparity. But you cannot drive completely through the main thoroughfare of Kercheval. That's because Grosse Pointe Park erected farmers' market sheds right in the middle of the street at the Detroit border. This past weekend, Grosse Pointe Park removed two sheds from the street. Two more remain blocking traffic. Reporter Bill McGraw has been digging into what people on both sides of that border say about those sheds, and he's done it for Bridge Magazine. Bill, 30 years ago, the border between Grosse Pointe Park and Detroit was dubbed the most conspicuous city-suburban contrast in the United States. Take us on a tour of this border.
Well, what's interesting about the Grosse Pointes in Detroit is most wealthy suburbs in Metro Detroit are miles from Detroit itself. But in Grosse Pointe, for four of the five Grosse Pointes, the border literally runs right next to your city. In Grosse Pointe Park, it runs through backyards. It runs through a store. It runs down the middle of an alley between people in Detroit and people in Grosse Pointe. So the border is really intimate. It also, while it's mostly invisible, it's solid in some places too. Grosse Pointe has blocked off, besides Kercheval, over the years, they've blocked off six other streets. And so there's steel guardrails, there's brick walls, and there's signs that just say road ends. Overall, the border stretches for 6 miles from the water on one point. It goes up Alter Road and then kind of turns northeast on Mack Avenue, and then it turns again by St. John Hospital, and it ends just north of St. John Hospital in an area where Harper Woods, Grosse Pointe Woods, and Detroit come together, and there's no markings there, and you can't tell which city is which. So the border has a lot of diversity along it. But in general, it's a very wealthy, white suburb on one side and a poor, majority African-American city on the other.
And you focus for your story in Bridge on these farmers' sheds that Grosse Pointe Park put up in the middle of Kercheval this summer, two of which were removed over the weekend. Kercheval's a really busy street, isn't it?
It is a busy street. It used to be busier because the area on the Detroit side of Kercheval and Alter has really become decimated over the years, and there's a lot less commerce and there's a lot fewer people living there. But it is a main thoroughfare along with Jefferson and Mack Avenue. Grosse Pointe street system is really just the Detroit system. They're on the same grid. The streets all have the same names and everything. It's just that...
Well, Jefferson becomes Lakeshore Drive.
Well, eventually it does.
It does, as you move in. And we should talk a little for those who aren't familiar with that corner of Wayne County. There are five Grosse Pointes, and they all have distinct personalities and income levels as well.
Right. And Grosse Pointe Park, I think, is in many ways the most interesting because it's the most diverse. And that's another thing. You know, we use the sheds for the Bridge story as sort of the jumping off point for the story. It was really about the border itself. In Grosse Pointe Park, the first six streets into Grosse Pointe Park from Detroit, running north and south, are, I think, one of the most interesting neighborhoods in Metro Detroit.
How so?
Well, they're 1920s-era houses, flats, small apartment buildings. They're very tightly put together. There's very few driveways, really. It's kind of more of a working-class neighborhood, and it's filled with people who are Wayne State students, retirees. There's a lot of African-Americans. That's another thing that Grosse Pointe Park has, over 10% African-American population. It's growing fairly rapidly. It's going to be higher at the next census. So that's why Grosse Pointe Park is different than the other Grosse Pointes. Plus, of course, Grosse Pointe Park has lots of wealth. There's long streets with beautiful lawns and beautiful Tudor homes and other style homes, and then true mansions on Windmill Point that open onto the lake.
So the sheds appeared this summer, and as you said, it's the jumping off point to this. What was the reasoning city officials gave for putting these sheds up?
Well, the west side of Kercheval in Grosse Pointe Park is an up-and-coming district. It's always been a commercial district, but it was kind of showing some signs of blight over the last several years. And there's been a big concentrated effort led by a family called the Cottons, who have made a lot of investment there in land and real estate. There's a few new restaurants and a couple bars. There's the Atwater in the Park Brewery and an old church, which has proven to be a very successful place. This is all in the last couple of years, and there's even some more plans. Not everything has been implemented as they wanted. So the farmers market existed before, but now it's put down on the west side and on the border, And it was, according to the officials, to improve the district. I attended three meetings in Grosse Pointe Park during September and early October. A lot of citizens turned out to say that they didn't like the secrecy with which the sheds were erected, and they don't like the sheds. Now, that's not saying there aren't people who like the sheds in Grosse Pointe, but they weren't at the meetings.
How many people were putting it out on the table that they felt this was a way to keep Detroiters out?
You know, it's interesting because even a number of African-American Grosse Pointers I spoke to said that they're willing to take the officials at their word that this was about improving the district. But they saw it as very awkward and even kind of bumbling the way it was done. And no one that I talked to, and I talked to over two dozen people on the Grosse Pointe side of the border, no one just said, oh, these guys are racist. But they said they did things that could easily be interpreted as racism. And the people in Detroit have had a little bit, you know, they sit there looking at Grosse Pointe. There's such a huge income gap on the two sides. You know, once upon a time in the 60s and 70s, both sides of the border all along it were white. There still was a class division, but the fact that it's majority black on one side and still majority white on the other causes its own kinds of tension.
And these sheds are examples of kind of a pattern of barriers, aren't there?
Well, I don't think the other Grosse Pointes have barriers along the border, since Grosse Pointe Park has half of the total border between Grosse Pointe and Detroit.
And as you say, as you go along Mac, it's not as pronounced as it is going
along. It changes. It does. Because at one point, the Detroit side is East English Village, which is, while fighting against blight, it's still a very coherent neighborhood. And it's a largely middle class neighborhood, too, in many ways. So the border does change. That's what I mean. There's a lot of diversity on both sides, even within this bigger issue. There are a number of streets, all of them side streets, that have been blocked off so that once upon a time when you could, say, go up Somerset Street, turn right or left on Mack Avenue, or if you were in Detroit, come into Grosse Pointe on Somerset, you can't do that anymore. There's a barrier.
There are still streets that are open, though.
Oh, most of the streets. Of the streets that connect with Detroit and Grosse Pointe Park.
Charlevoix.
Exactly. The ones that are closed come to almost a quarter of the streets. There's only about 30 streets connecting the two cities.
The connection between these two communities, as you say, it is kind of intimately linked. And even though there's been efforts to enforce kind of a distinct separation, they're linked. You had the downturn of the economy and the auto industry spared neither Detroiters or people in Grosse Pointe who work downtown. What's behind this lingering divide, do you think, in 2014?
Well, you know, I think obviously the racial divide is there. But what I found that was interesting is people at these meetings, given the fact that Grosse Pointe, and especially Grosse Pointe Park, is so close to Detroit, the City Hall in Grosse Pointe Park is only 6 miles from the Detroit City Hall. And many people in Grosse Pointe work in Detroit. Many people in Grosse Pointe Park lived in Detroit once upon a time. And many of them go to events in Detroit. They're very knowledgeable about Detroit activities. That came up in these meetings where they were talking about how much they love Detroit. They bicycle downtown and on and on. So there's a real connection, too, that can't be denied and is really there between, you know, many people who live in Grosse Pointe. On the other hand, there are people talked about their neighbors who are concerned about crime, even though crime is extremely low in Grosse Pointe. It's much higher on the other side of the border, obviously. But there are incidents. Last year in Grosse Pointe Park, I believe there was an average of about 2 burglaries every month. People talk about the burglaries and the word gets around. So even though the crime rate is low, crime is a concern in the Grosse Pointes. So I think those are reasons for the divide, but there's also reasons why there's this big connection between the Grosse Pointes and Detroit, too.
You also point out in your piece for Bridge that black Detroiters coming on certain roads can pretty well expect that they might be greeted by a police officer.
Right. And I also pointed out that that's not new.
Right.
When the border was white on both sides, people in Detroit knew if they had had an extra drink, they better not drive on the Grosse Pointe side of Mack Avenue. But of course, now that it takes on a racial cast, it's different. However, every single person, white or black Detroiter or Grosse Pointer I talked to, said that the Grosse Pointe police patrol Mack Avenue especially very intensely. And people do interpret that different ways. I went to traffic court for one of their sessions, and 58% of the people who were there for fighting traffic tickets appeared to be African American. And like I said in the Bridge story, I'm not sure what that means. What should the percentage be? You know, we're talking about busy streets and a big community that's majority African American next to a smaller community, but it was noticeable that the majority were African American, but it is something that everyone's well aware of. And white girls pointers get tickets too. The judge said, he's been the judge there for 20 years, he said that he doesn't see a pattern. He thinks that people get tickets because they're breaking the law.
How much do you think, Bill, that last spring's beating of Steve Utesh, the white tree trimmer from Macomb County by that group of black men on Detroit's east side, how much do you think that is fueling fears amongst whites in Grosse Pointe?
That wasn't far from Grosse Pointe. Mm-hmm. And people in Grosse Pointe would be very familiar with Marang, where it happened. And there was another incident closer to Grosse Pointe, just a few blocks away on Verner, after the Utesh beating, where a Grosse Pointer went the wrong way for a couple blocks on Verner and hit somebody, and they got out and they're accused of beating him. They're waiting a trial or going through the judicial process. That's another thing that people brought up. I quoted somebody in a story who said she grew up in Detroit, spends a lot of time in Detroit. She's a Grosse Pointer, and she felt fear for the first time in her life when she was on Verner at the same spot where that guy was attacked early in the summer. Nothing happened to her, but she felt that, and she spoke very honestly about it, and she also spoke about her love and how much time she spends in Detroit and everything.
So it sounds like she really is trying to wrestle with this, as are so many people.
Right. But, you know, another thing that's happening, too, is that Grosse Pointe, while slower than a lot of the communities along the Detroit border, is integrating slowly. The Grosse Pointe schools are about 20% African-American overall. Grosse Pointe North High School, which has Harper Woods students who are part of the Grosse Pointe district, is 29% African-American. So, and I pointed out on the Grosse Pointe corner of Nottingham and Mack, all the businesses there are owned by African-Americans, including a new restaurant owned by J. Lee Deering, who's part of the family that owns Burt's Marketplace in Eastern Market. And Mr. Deering lives in Grosse Pointe. So slowly but surely, Grosse Pointe is sort of catching up with a lot of the other suburban communities in the Detroit area, and that's changing the dynamic too. It's going to be really interesting to see what they come up with and whether it opens up a new era between the two cities, but the socioeconomic barriers are still going to be there, not to mention the physical ones too.
In the last minute we have, what do you think the lesson of this border is for the rest of Michigan?
Well, how do people who live in communities that are prosperous and have great police response, what is their obligation to neighbors who are, even if they don't live right next door, but who live elsewhere in the state that are Michiganders, that for some reason, for historical reasons even, live in communities that have poor police response and poor schooling? You know, Michigan's not going to progress until the communities that are disadvantaged are brought up a little bit. And this, the Grosse Pointe-Detroit border, every day, that issue is right out there in the open.
Bill McGraw, always good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bill McGraw's story, Border Crossing, the Long Fraught History of the Detroit-Grosse Pointe Divide, can be found at Bridge Magazine at bridgemi.com. Does a bar have to serve alcohol? What if you wanted the lively atmosphere of a bar, a place to go meet friends, but for whatever the reason, you do not want to drink alcohol? Nick Sims thinks she has the answer for you. She's created the Brillig Dry Bar, a new pop-up bar in Ann Arbor. No alcohol. Nick is with us now. Why a dry bar? What's the point?
I haven't had a drink in 20 years. I'm the child of a sober alcoholic. My mother's celebrating 31 years this month. And I know a lot of people who don't drink for many different reasons, religious reasons, health reasons. And I'd like just as much as anybody else to go out on a Friday or Saturday night. But I'm finding that current bar atmospheres, there are TVs everywhere, there's alcohol, things get sloppy late in the evening. And I just don't want that energy. I want all of the fun and none of the regret.
None of the regret, which there can be. And it's not the same as going to a bar and saying, I'll have ginger ale.
No, really, I think it feels really different, especially in our situation. I mean, I want it to feel safe. I want it to feel fun. I want it to feel lively. And I think minus the alcohol, for a lot of people, the safety factor is a big deal.
And it's not the same as a coffee shop?
Not at all. Like, I wouldn't encourage you to bring your laptop or a book to read while we were having the dry bar open.
Because?
It's loud. It's energetic. We had live jazz for our first night. We hope to have a whole calendar of events in the coming year where we might have a comic night. We might have a bar trivia night. Lots more music, lots more entertainment. And we just really want it to be a place where you go out with your mates.
And have a good time. And what would you drink? Give me an idea what you have on the menu.
So as a nod to Michigan, because I've been living here for over 20 years now, I invented a Werner's Cranberry Sour. Shrubs are very popular right now in kind of the handcrafted bar scene. But a shrub can be fermented. And I didn't want to have any alcohol with it. So I came up with a shrub-like sour flavor using our dear local Werner's and cranberries because of the season.
Very cool. You have to tell us what the name means.
Sure. So Brillig comes from the Jabberwocky poem, which is a Lewis Carroll nonsense poem. I think it appears in Alice in Wonderland, but it's a favorite of mine. I mean, I'm really trying to do everything that's authentic to me. So I was an English major in college. Jabberwocky was a big part of that study process. I also consider the Jabberwocky to be the metaphor for the demons or the monkeys on our back. And there's a whole part of the poem in which a boy takes his vorpal sword and slays the Jabberwocky. And so for me, it's very much about how can we have a place where, and this is a message to the recovery community specifically, mm-hmm. because that's a big part of my life. How can we have a place where you feel safe, you can leave all that behind and just come in and feel good? And then Brillig literally means the time of day when you transition from lunch food to evening food. And so it had the evening connotations. I mean, it was just the perfect word for it.
So what are your plans going forward?
So we're having another one December 26th, which is Boxing Day, which we're very excited about. We had a lot of surveys our first night. We specifically asked people, what do you like? What would you change? What can we do differently? Some of those comments we're able to execute on, like we're going to have dimmer lights. That was a big one. They wanted even more bar-like atmosphere. We're going to try to have some live music, and then we're going to spend all of the Christmas and New Year's holiday planning out the 2015 calendar. We want to run this at least monthly, but given the overwhelming response and the deep need that was unanticipated when we first thought of this, we're going to try to do it a little more frequently than that.
Well, you can get all the information on their website, brilligdrybar.com, and it's B-R-I-L-L-I-G, drybar.com. Nick Sims, thank you so much for speaking with us, and I'm going to have to stop by and try that pumpkin pie in a glass.
Do. Thank you so much. This is great.
Today, Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Zach Dieberman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.